Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter John McCutcheon. His latest release is the album Field of Stars, a project he intended to record in 2020. When the pandemic made recording the material he'd written back then impossible, he shelved the idea and instead wrote and recorded three other albums in quick succession, including one with Tom Paxton called Together. When McCutcheon finally got back to Field of Stars, his vision had shifted, and he found himself drawing on a different batch of material than he'd expected. The results are an album that stands as among his best work in a career that now spans over 52 years. We covered that and much more in this conversation, which took place in January of this year. That's John McCutcheon on Into Music, coming up now. I want to talk to you about the record Field of Stars, and this has an interesting story because this was a record that you were supposed to make back in 2020. Things happened, and then you came back around to it, but it wound up not being the record that you would have made at that time.
The pandemic put me in a different direction. I found I really discovered a new way of writing during the pandemic, something that was much more focused and yet a little looser, if that's not too much of an oxymoron. And when I went back over these songs, and it probably would have been that way had even if it hadn't been for the pandemic, you just in the course of 5 years, number one, hopefully you become a more skilled writer. And secondly, you're going to have enough new material that you think, well, this body of work sort of bumps some of these songs out. And not to say that some of these songs won't eventually be recorded, but, you know, I've been doing so much writing and so much writing with other people as well. I write with five or six different people a week. In fact, when I get done with this interview, I have a session, my weekly session with Tom Paxton, which is one of the great joys of my week. And so when I put everything on the table, there were some things that I thought, given the particular time we're living in, that ought to come out. And some stuff like Too Old to Die Young that I wrote almost as a novelty song, but so many people, I guess, thought that they needed that at their 70th birthday parties. And I am kind of running with an older crowd these days. So it how albums get put together is an interesting alchemy of what you have in your catalog that you think ought to come out and some things that outside factors make more urgent.
So you mentioned this change that happened with writing during the pandemic. I would imagine that over the years, there have been times where things have shifted and it's like, oh, I don't write the way that I used to. Is that something that you just, you know, you think as a writer, gosh, I've got to be open to that, that maybe another door is going to open at some point. I'm going to see a different path in a different way.
Oh, I think that here I am at 72, still having a really vibrant creative life. I mean, I'm glad I didn't end up being a dancer, for instance, or a football player. But, you know, I do a lot of teaching of songwriting. And one of the things that I always tell the folks who've been crazy enough to want to spend a week with me talking about this ancient art is that the more I do it, the less I'm certain how it happens. The thing that I learned in the early days of the pandemic was a new way of preparing myself to really let go. And any artist will tell you that art is not about control, it's about abandon. And once you have the basic mechanics down, what you really hope for is that time when you can lose yourself in the process. And now, anybody who's listened to my music or seen me perform know I'm not a woo-woo kind of guy. But this is real, and every writer will tell you that. Tom Paxton once said in a songwriting workshop we were doing at a festival, there are some songs you write and other songs you simply write down. And you don't need to be a songwriter to understand that. Sometimes, you know, it can be a letter to the editor or a sympathy note or a poem you're writing for some occasion or whatever. And you just look at it and you say, wow, I'm not that good. There was something else moving here. And I found that at the early days of the pandemic, because every other part of my work was taken away from me, doing concerts, going into the studio, the last thing I had left that I could do was writing. And so I got to spend a lot more time on that. I did it earlier in the day, which was a real revelation, because I have a sort of a constitutional I go through early in the morning. And I found that right after I did that, I was really ready to write. And so like everything, whether it be technology or tragedy, often related, you can find good stuff and bad stuff as a result of it all.
So you mentioned being 72 and finding yourself in a really fruitful period of writing. And I'm 52, and I can remember being in my 20s and thinking, yeah, at some point there's going to be like a stopping point to this creativity stuff. Like it's just going to, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Do you think it's just the longer that you practice it, the more that it reveals itself to you?
I think that's part of it. You know, Paul Simon talked about just hitting writer's block. I think it's a real thing. Luckily, I've never experienced it. And I have people who come into my songwriting camps saying, I'm here because I've hit a wall and I don't know how to get out of it. And apparently the way I teach is different enough that even experienced writers can come in and say, oh, well, that's a way to do it that I hadn't thought about before. And, you know, I was 20 years old when I came south on what I thought was an independent study for 3 months. And here we are 53 years ago later. And I think as you get older, hopefully you get more humble about your ignorance and you understand how you can cure that, because ignorance is curable. Stupidity is an entirely different animal. And I just never seem to run out of inspiration. And part of it is putting your ass in the chair and doing the work. Because lots of us in the course of a day get a good, what they think is a good idea, and they just never act on it. Because I'm in a field that retirement doesn't compute in quite the same way. Certainly, there are musicians who say, you know, I've played in the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra long enough, and it's more like an everyday job. They have to show up every day at the Symphony Hall for rehearsals and stuff like that. And they're finally ready to be done with that, but they never really stop playing. And I guess Pete Seeger shamed us all by at 94 showing up at Occupy Wall Street on two canes just to try to be helpful. So it makes me feel selfish if I would say, oh, I'm just going to hang up the old banjo and stay home, though I love staying home. I'm just performing a lot less and writing a lot more.
You touched on something that I was curious about, which was that coming down south. When you were a kid growing up in Wisconsin, was the South a place that was kind of a point of fascination to you, or?
I think growing up in the late 50s, early 60s, the South was definitely a mysterious place because the Civil Rights Movement was playing out there in vivid detail every night on the news. And the whole notion of separate bathrooms and swimming pools and drinking fountains, though we called them bubblers in Wisconsin, just didn't compute. And as I got more involved in music, I started playing the guitar at 14. I went off to college and I met some kids from Arkansas, started playing the banjo, and you know, fell into that deep rabbit hole. Everybody that I talked to, including Pete Seeger, said, if you want to learn more about this instrument and this music, you have to go south. And so I did. I didn't think I would stay, but I fell in love with it for lots of different reasons. And part of the reason I'm still here is that it's such a big subject, the music, the people, the, you know, I came down here thinking that I was coming here to learn to play a musical instrument. But what fascinated me right away when I got in here was how music was a glue in communities. It was instrumental rather than ornamental to community life. This is where this all made sense, where musicians mattered and had, and I don't mean as from a celebrity standpoint, they had a job to do. They played in church, they played on picket lines, they played for the square dances. They were a hub of community, it was connective tissue. And that was really, really interesting to me. And it's the kind of musician I've tried to be, that you're there more, it's not about showing off, it's what can happen in a room or on a festival stage with a group of people for this limited period of time, and how you can sort of help support, and even in some cases, maybe create that sense of community. And I think people are really hungry for that. I just got back from a tour of Northern California, and boy, everywhere I went, it really felt like people wanted to and needed to be together. And the music concert was an excuse for that.
It's always interesting, having been at picking parties or things like that, you do see that sense of community. Somebody says, hey, come over Saturday night, we're going to play some songs on the back porch. And the way that stories get told, not just through the songs, but sometimes a song will bring up a story from somebody's past, and you get to connect with them in such a wonderful way.
Well, there's a kind of vulnerability that goes on when you agree to lend your voice, your skill as an instrumentalist, to something that's bigger than yourself. And it's definitely something you can't create alone. I mean, you can certainly play music alone, but there's a kind of dynamism and wonderfulness when people do this thing together. I mean, look, you're in Wichita. And so a lot of your listeners know about the Winfield Festival. Winfield is two festivals, really. There's the festival that I participate in, which is a series of concerts, workshops, whatever. And then there's the whole campground. And I have run into people who have never been to a stage show, who go there to be in the campground, and the kind of community and ecosystem that creates. And I totally get that. I started off playing for little folk music societies all across America, and most of them were not created to be concert presenters. They were created so that people could have a place to play music with one another and get better at it and learn how to do it and sing together and dance together and have a songwriter's guitar pull. All that kind of stuff. And oh yeah, so-and-so is coming through town and I think our greater community would enjoy this. But that wasn't the reason they existed. And that speaks to a much more organic and sustainable thing, really. I mean, I'm old enough that people like you often say, well, what was it like? How do you compare folk music today with the 60s, when it was on television, on the front page of Time magazine, and you could hear it on the radio? I mean, AM radio. And my response is always, well, there are way more people playing it now. There are way more people performing. There are way better instrumentalists. I mean, you basically had Doc Watson back then. And you had a small handful of songwriters that people knew about. And there's so many now. You could name, you know, the great singers. You had Joan Baez and Judy Collins and today there's so many great singers. I mean, and people are playing it in their homes, which is way more where it belongs and signals to me a greater health than how many people showed up at a concert, how many albums someone sold, how many Grammys somebody won. That's all focused on an individual. And that's nice, but it's a much broader kind of thing. There, you know, they didn't have the number of dances going on in every community like they do now. I mean, it's way healthier, way more widespread, and way more participated in than ever.
Do people ever come to you, or maybe you have these conversations sometimes when you've been on the road or something, and you're playing in a town maybe that doesn't have a, they've got venues, but maybe they don't have a particularly vibrant scene or sense of community. And do people ask you, you know, like, how do we sustain this? How do we keep this going?
Well, luckily, you know, up the road from you in Kansas City, there's the Folk Alliance. And that's a place that has been, that proved a gathering ground for people in both individually and organizationally to talk to one another and get to know one another. So that's one place I would send them, and they could be put in touch with other communities that have started things from scratch. But a lot of times people will meet one another at events like my concerts, for instance. They will come and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm really interested in learning to play the hammer dulcimer or learning about songwriting. And I can often say, oh, somebody just talked to me about it. It's that person right there. And with the kind of social media that's out there, like everything, like Zoom, it can be used for good or evil. And it's a way for people to connect. Just don't try to convince anybody of your opinion on Facebook, because it's never happened.
Right. Yeah. Well, that takes me to, I wanted to talk about a specific tune on the record, because you and I are talking on Holocaust Remembrance Day and the MS St. Louis, which is, I can vividly remember being at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, taking American Lit, maybe my junior year, and we were reading St. Clair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, and my professor telling us the story of the St. Louis, and my mouth was just like, I couldn't believe that this had happened.
Well, and one day, somebody at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater will hear about the mass deportations that are planned right now. And like the MS St. Louis, they will not believe that people, simply because of not who they were, but what they were refused asylum. And there's a difference in the people who are coming in. These are not just faceless, they become avatars of our own fears and our own prejudices. And yes, every country needs to have a way to understand what borderlines are. Individuals need to understand what borderlines are. But the MS St. Louis was something that most of my, if not all of my Jewish friends knew, because they'd grown up hearing about it. And in almost every album that I've done in recent years, I realized, because somebody pointed it out to me, I've included something about Jewish history, and especially relating to the Holocaust. And in fact, there's two Jewish themed songs on this album, including Tikkun Olam, which is a fundamental tenet of especially American Judaism. I often look to history to shine a light on contemporary things, whether it be Christmas Eve in World War I, when people realized, oh, we're singing the same song, and the anonymity that is a prerequisite of war was suddenly broken down, and these were other sons and fathers that were away from home and their loved ones at Christmas. It was a pointed thing for me to write this song. I just think that in these times, the ability to give some way and people a new way to think about things is one of the things that I try to do as a writer. Because we all, you know, we as Americans, we generally don't know history very well. Everything that's happening is happening for the first time right now. And of course, that's not true. And it's been shocking to me since October 7th of last year, how many young people don't even know about the Holocaust, or they don't believe that 6 million people died. And I've today is the when we're speaking is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And I've been to Auschwitz, and it is a tangibly evil place. And I was really affected by it, and have been affected by the many elderly people, almost all gone now, who were Holocaust survivors, and think that especially in these times when anti-Semitism is making such an unbelievable resurgence, that it is the job of non-Jews to speak out in much the same way that men have to speak out about, you know, abuse of women, and white people have to speak out on abuse of colored people, and straight people have to stand up for gay people. I mean, this, if we're going to be the kind of multicultural society that we were founded to be and that we are, you know, I just, from the beginning of my consciousness about the world, raised by my ex-social worker mother who sent me to Catholic schools, it was inevitable. And watching the great events that happened during my life, I mean, the civil rights movement was front and center when I was growing up, and it introduced me to folk music. The March on Washington was the first time I was conscious of the fact that there was a thing called folk music, and it was connected to something bigger than the individuals that were participating in this. So that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, yeah, I mean, you touched on a couple of things, and I visited Auschwitz in 2002, and it was just, I'll just never forget, you know, taking this, it was like a 45-minute bus ride there and back. And initially when I booked that, I thought, that's a long time to be on a bus, but I was so grateful that I had that time to reflect and absorb before I had to go back to, you know, civilization.
Right. And what was shocking to me is that it's right in town. It's, you know, we have this image that all of these death camps were like Bergen-Belsen, off someplace. Auschwitz, there's apartment buildings right up to the walls. And it's, you know, granted, they're recent buildings, but it was in town. It was in town. People couldn't escape the fact that, what were these ashes falling in our yard? I think that there's a song on one of my recent albums, I think it might have been Leap, called Second Hand, that I wrote after reading the obituary of the oldest Holocaust survivor in Greece, who spent her time going to schools and talking to kids about what had happened, because she doubted, and was probably right, that it wasn't in their history book, certainly not a firsthand account. And I thought, as we lose Holocaust survivors, as we lose World War II veterans, as more and more veterans of the civil rights movement and so on, and everything becomes secondhand, who tells those stories? And I imagine that music is one way to tell those stories.
Do you know the Barry Levinson film Avalon?
I don't.
So, you know, it starts Baltimore, you know, early 20th century, and there's a grandfather telling his grandchildren about, you know, how he came over on the boat. And of course, everybody wants to hear grandpa tell a story. And by the end of the film, it's late 1960s, 1970s, and the children are focused on the TV as opposed to the grandfather. And it's just such a, yeah, I think a powerful way of communicating what we're talking about, of that when the story ends or when the story doesn't get passed on, you know?
Well, and how does it in fact get passed on? When I first wrote Christmas in the Trenches, this is 40 years ago now, it was surprising to me how few people at the time had ever heard that story. And it's taught in English schools. It was at that time still being repressed in German schools, because when I played in Germany, people would say, we've never heard that story. And I said, and you guys instigated it. You were the first. It was a German that came out of the trenches with the Christmas tree. So the way, when certain means of communication break down, hopefully, you know, nature and culture abhors a vacuum. So writers start flooding into those areas, and the end of a modern version of Avalon would be people staring at their phones instead of their televisions. And you see it in restaurants. You can see two couples at a table, and they're all looking at their phones instead of communicating to one another. And that will be the end of my old fart rant.
We touched a little bit on, you know, the world as it is in this moment. So I would imagine you as a writer and your colleagues, you're thinking about that and thinking about the importance of recording this moment.
A lot of us have really different ways of going about it. There are people who are writing, and believe me, it's easy to write because there's lots of low-hanging fruit right now. Writing things that are real short shelf life songs, a term that my buddy Tom Paxson created. Stuff that is, well, for instance, the song Ukrainian Now that Tom and I wrote and was the lead cut on our album together. We wrote this in the opening days of the Ukraine-Russia war, and we both really felt like it needed to get out there. So I made a Facebook video and put it out, because there you have a sense of urgency with stuff that's really timely, topical. So there's the point of capturing that lightning in a bottle, that moment when people are focused on really what's going on now. And it can be anything from presenting a new idea, a new way of thinking about this, like the MS St. Louis, for instance, a way to sustain those people who are kind of in the front lines of societal change. I mean, you know, one of the most oft lofted critiques of topical music is that, oh, well, you're just preaching to the choir. Well, a USO show is preaching to the choir. And so I think a lot of topical music is designed to give courage and solidarity and a sense that you're not alone. You're not crazy. There are other people, and maybe this will help. And those things, when I write it or when Tom writes it or when we write them together, are often humorous, because if people can laugh at the same thing together, that's progress. That's the start of a conversation. But there's also that notion that somebody needs to write this down so that it's not forgotten in the future. And maybe it'll help somewhere along the way to make the burden a little easier down the road. And, I'm a grandfather. I'm thinking about that kind of stuff now in a more focused way than I ever have before.
You've been listening to a conversation with veteran folk singer-songwriter John McCutcheon. His latest release is Field of Stars, which was issued in January of this year. To learn more about him and the record, you can visit folkmusic.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast at kmuw.org. And we do welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Each morning, It's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.